Hello, this is Scott McQueen, and we're about to watch the perfect horror movie, James Whale's 1935 Universal production of Bride of Frankenstein. Wanting nothing to do with a sequel to his 1931 film Frankenstein, James Whale responded to the inevitable with style, wit, and production value. He extracted the absolute best in concept and craft from his cast and his technical staff. Every department does a star turn under a director who knew exactly the effect he wanted. An opera of the macabre, distilling ideas and fusing imagery from myriad antecedents, instilling them with subtext and theme. Mastery, control, and purpose inform every frame of this remarkable film. A stellar cast of largely British principals is amended at the bottom with the monster's mate, played by a question mark. The servant walking Lord Byron's hounds is Irish actress Una O'Connor. We'll meet her again shortly in her principal role as Minnie, housekeeper of Castle Frankenstein. This whimsical doubling foreshadows what will occur with actress Elsa Lanchester. In an hour or so, we'll meet Elsa as the monster's bride. Here she is as Mary Godwin. The cast list notwithstanding, she's not Mary Shelley yet. The prologue was conceived by Whale and first written by Edmund Pearson. Pearson created anachronisms, as he put it, for the benefit of the censors. In historical reality, English poet Percy Shelley abandoned his wife Harriet and their two children to live abroad with his lover, Mary Godwin. Mary bore their love child, William. They wed only after Harriet's convenient suicide, coincident with the publication of Frankenstein in 1818. Its author, also anonymous, like the cipher in the Universal cast list. As originally produced, the prologue celebrated the naughty behavior of its principals. We are all three infidels, scoffers at all marriage ties, believing only in living fully and freely, stated Mary, in dialogue cut from the prologue, along with lingering views of Elsa's décolletage. When Mary refers to such an audience, she doesn't mean her reading public, but her circle of friends. Contract player Frank Lawton was considered to play Shelley. David Niven tested for the part, but was rejected. Screenwriter John Balderston worked the prologue into his second draft, but only in William Hurlbut's final script was the precision of language and theatricality achieved that make Bride of Frankenstein so memorable. Eight writers worked on the film, but the story and language of Bride of Frankenstein is ultimately due almost entirely to William Hurlbut and James Whale.
I think.
Then, darling, you will have much to answer for.
The publishers did not see that my purpose was to write a moral lesson. The punishment that befell a mortal man who dared to emulate God.
Well, whatever your purpose may have been, my dear, I take great relish in savoring each separate horror. I roll them over on my tongue.
Don't, Lord Byron. Don't remind me of it tonight.
What a setting in that churchyard.
This shot of the funeral cortege was the original opening of the 1931 Frankenstein, curiously still missing from prints today. As originally recorded, Franz Waxman's music for the prologue ran 5 3/4 minutes, indicating that the sequence has been trimmed by nearly 2 minutes. Waxman scored the prologue as salon music of the early 19th century, utilizing strings and celeste to create a delicate minuet in ABCA form. Statement, development, followed by a scherzo as the original picture's horrors are relived in flashback. The scherzo is a minor-keyed, syncopated variation of the minuet. At each depiction of the monster in the flashback, is sounded a 9-note ascending-descending chromatic run, patterned on the monster's growl. It will recur as a danger motive several times in the score, usually in conjunction with the 5-tone third interval motive for the monster. The musical motive for the monster that we heard in the main title is saved for Karloff's first entrance. That was Torben Meyer, the mustache being throttled by the monster, the only new footage in the flashback. Meyer played the Danish tenant in Universal's Murders in the Rue Morgue. Several of Whale's associates thought the prologue immaterial. Film editor Ted Kent argued for its complete elimination. As the flashback ends, the demure A section of the minuet returns. The anticipatory mood is reflected by Waxman as the violins play the minuet Calenio, tapping the wood of their bows against the strings. The meter slows, the musical phrase fails to complete, the key changes to minor with drawn strings.
Soon the bare skeleton of the building will be visible, the gaunt rafters against the sky.
In what period and place is this story occurring? Post-Tesla generators, telephonic electrical devices, and 1930s Marcel hairstyles will coexist with a peasantry by Bruegel. Burgomasters and serfs with Teutonic names like Hans and Carl speak in accents hailing from Glasgow, County Cork, and Pasadena. Quote, I've taken the rest of the story far into the future and made use of developments which science will someday know, 100 years to come, unquote, said Mary Shelley in dialogue removed from the prologue, rationalizing an alternate universe peppered with anachronisms. Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, The Mikado, takes place in a Japan that is suspiciously like Victorian England. In a similar fashion, the English-born whale has created a Goldstadt that is really a British never-never land. Several 1935 press squibs actually stated that the locale for the picture is England. In a contemporary interview, Whale explained, quote, the whole of the theater, both stage and screen, is unreal, and if for an hour and a half the audience can be transported into a strange atmosphere in which unnatural things happen, but appear to happen naturally and believably, the object of the film producer is accomplished. Unquote. While the intention is a thrilling melodrama, states a production note attached to a working synopsis of the script, it is punctuated throughout by the comedy of the burgomaster and the housekeeper, who voiced the skepticism of the audience in a similar manner to The Invisible Man. Whale knew during the writing exactly who would play these two. Essentially reprising their roles from that 1933 film, are Whale favorites E.E. Clive as the burgomaster and Una O'Connor as Minnie, the housekeeper. These parts were written for these specific performers. The unforgettable role of Dr. Pretorius appears to have been tailored for Claude Rains. It is not known why Rains bowed out. According to studio memos of a later period, he definitely declined the Basil Rathbone part in Son of Frankenstein because it was a horror picture. Ernest Thesiger, another Whale favorite, would fill the gap, dramatically changing the movie's orbit. The old Baron Frankenstein, referred to here by the burgomaster, is never mentioned again. In the preview version of the film, the news of Henry's alleged death has done the old man in. Though the Baron was never shown, the priest and altar boys who administered last rites were, and they can still be found in one or two production stills. The parents of Little Maria, the child drowned by the monster in the original film, are played by Reginald Barlow and Mary Gordon. Michael Mark had played the father in Frankenstein, where he was called Ludwig. Reginald Barlow, here called Hans, appeared in the concurrently produced Werewolf of London as the estate caretaker, Timothy. Upon reviewing the November 30th, 1934 shooting script, Joseph Breen, the omnipotent industry censor of the Production Code Administration, wrote the studio, quote, we counted 10 separate scenes in which the monster either strangles or tramples people to death. This in addition to some other murders by secondary characters. Such a great amount of slaughter is unwise, and we recommend very earnestly that you do something about toning this down. Whale balked. Kill them all. Let Breen sort them out. Whale's first cut contained no less than 21 deaths, either committed or alluded to. After Breen's sorting, the casualty rate plummeted to a mere 10 confirmed decedents. Franz Waxman's famous five-note motive for the monster, usually played by brass, provides the backbone of the score and will recur in various musical guises and developments, including flutter-tonguing for danger and harmon mutes for comic effect. As developed, it comments both on the creature and other characters' reactions to him. Poor Mary Gordon is Hans' wife. With nary a complaint, her Mrs. Hudson suffered for years the eccentricities of Basil Rathbone in the Sherlock Holmes films. The Scottish-born actress is tossed into the cistern here by Boris Karloff and would be throttled in her nightgown by Lon Chaney in The Mummy's Tomb. She survived a rematch with Karloff in The Body Snatcher, only to see Boris bludgeon her wee doggie and steal her son's corpse. That's Hollywood for you. Jack Pierce brilliantly extrapolated Karloff's makeup in Bride, creating several stages of distress and regeneration, all in narrative continuity. The wounded monster healed as the picture progressed. Karloff seems fleshier because he is more heavily padded than in the first film. The requirement that the monster speak means that he does not remove his dental plate as he did in the first film, forfeiting the cadaverous, sunken cheek. Nor did Pierce paint him with as many hollows. The painted hollow in the monster's cheek would become an annoying grace note, until in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, it looked like Bela Lugosi's monster and Ilona Massey's heroine both sported dueling beauty marks. Elizabeth, the true bride of Frankenstein, played by a 17-year-old Valerie Hobson, truly a child bride, well would have liked Mae Clark as original, but her frail health by 1935 made this impossible. Darcy Corrigan, who has a showy part as the morgue attendant in Murders in the Rue Morgue, delivers the bad news to Valerie. He is flanked by the family of Wales' longtime companion, David Lewis. His father, Fanny Levy, is the chubby peasant woman. His father, Pon Levy, the stout, bearded man. David's sister, Leah Bishan, is the sweet-faced peasant girl blinking back tears. Leah's daughter, Julie May, recalls Uncle Jimmy helping the Levys survive the Great Depression with extra work in Bride, One More River, and The Road Back. How soon after the success of Frankenstein was a sequel planned? According to Robert Florey, the disinvited director of the original Frankenstein, almost immediately. Florey submitted an unsolicited 7-page spec treatment, which was returned to him without comment in February 1932. Frankenstein hit, and Money Machine, and Carl Laemmle Jr. wanted more. James Whale refused, finding the entire premise repellent. Former newspaper man Tom Reed wrote a sequel in June and July 1933, floating random chunks of the Shelley novel into his own mindless stew. The now-educated monster demands a mate, killing Elizabeth to supply body parts. Henry destroys himself and his creatures. The Old Baron, written in the grumpy voice of Frederick Kerr from the first film, monopolizes the first half of the script until the monster mercifully chokes him off. Then bad comedy with villagers, the bishop, a gay dance instructor, take over. Henry steals the legs of Frau von Hassenbergerwitz from a pompous undertaker's embalming room. He ambulance chases a train wreck to scavenge female body parts and steals the hydrocephalic head of a suicided circus giantess to build the bride. A glimmer or two emerge from the dross to be carried forward. The monster is seeing his reflection in a pool, his education and speech, the befriending of a blind man, the mate, the destruction of the lab, and the thematic seed of religious piety. Joseph Byrne and Morton Coyne prepared an independent visualization treatment based on Reed's material that was equally uneventful. By September 1933, Kurt Newman was announced to direct, but the returns on The Invisible Man made Whale the obvious, commercial, protesting choice. "They've had a script prepared," he told The Invisible Man's writer, R.C. Sheriff, "and it stinks to heaven." Whale was preparing Galsworthy's One More River with Sheriff, a property that Whale was passionate about, but that made the Laemmles yawn. A bargain was made, one for James, one for the Laemmles. Whale resigned himself to the sequel. Two original treatments were evolved independently by mystery writers Lawrence Blockman and Philip MacDonald in December 1933. Blockman's treatment seems partially inspired by Todd Browning's 1932 film Freaks. Henry and Elizabeth, incognito, have joined a traveling carnival as puppeteers. They reenact the monster's drama with marionettes. All of the carnival oddities have spouses and lovers, even Emma the lion tamer, who boasts about how she beats her husband, even as she dallies with Fifi the giantess. Enter the monster, wanting a love match. The bride is produced in a carnival wagon, and the enraged monster dies in the jaws of Emma's lions. Philip MacDonald's story was absolutely up to date, equally original as Blockman's and equally useless. War clouds over Europe, and Henry has developed his Delta Death Ray that he wishes to sell to the League of Nations as a deterrent to war. Henry has neglected his sickly wife Elizabeth, over whom family friend Victor Moritz is still spooning. A nocturnal demonstration of the ray inadvertently revives the monster, and a second exposure gives him superhuman strength. The monster plays with the dials of the apparatus like a child, inadvertently raining super scientific death and destruction across Europe, decimating whole cities. A remorseful Henry apologizes to his creature, vaporizes him with the ray, and then immolates himself in its being.
It seems to be reaching out for you, as if it would take you away from me.
It was written that Elizabeth's vision would be a classical Grim Reaper hovering beyond the window, a ghost of Christmas yet to come, bearing a strong whiff of the monster. It would have been dangerous to go over the top this soon in the picture with so many fancies yet to come. Far better to drop the other shoe with the arrival of Dr. Pretorius, a literal figure of death. We're ready for our wake-up call, Dr. P. Promethean hubris drives the story, at least in this telling of it. Henry rationalizes his blasphemy by conjecturing that his actions are part of the divine plan. The devil didn't make him do it. God did. Having created a shambling revenant with unpredictable powers, Frankenstein refuses to take responsibility for its care or destruction. James Whale was a man of absolutely no religious convictions, according to his biographer James Curtis. It has become fashionable to view the religious parable and Christ imagery in Bride of Frankenstein as mocking and to attribute it to nonconformity in Whale's character. This view assumes that the fey Dr. Pretorius is the director's absolute alter ego and that the godless reprobate represents an absolute alternative to the vulgar Philistines of Goldstadt. As the movie unfolds, I will suggest that the story's thesis is larger.
Dr. Pretorius? Pretorius? What was the name?
Dr. Pretorius.
There's no such name. Now you stay there. Minnie, my lady.
Oh, come in.
It's Dr. Pretorius. He says he wants to see the master. Most insistent.
Pretorius?
He's a very queer-looking old gentleman, sir. And must see you on a secret grave matter, he said. Tonight, alone.
Bring him in.
Henry, who is this man?
Dr. Pretorius.
His entrance here is yet another one of Whale's bravura stage entrances. Several pages of dialogue eliminated here made it clear that this is an old acquaintance. Pretorius had been Henry's teacher at school, passing on his forbidden Promethean knowledge. Henry's indiscretions in monster-making had been traced back to the doctor, causing Pretorius to be sacked. Pretorius also made it clear that the monster is most likely immortal.
Booted, my dear Baron, is the word. For knowing too much.
Henry's been very ill, Professor. He shouldn't be disturbed.
The invisible man merely dreamt of walking into the Holy of Holies. Dr. Pretorius has done it and stolen God's fire. Like all worthy devils, Pretorius is magnetic. He fascinates us with wit, intelligence, self-assurance. He tempts us by giving voice to our worst impulses. He controls destiny, irresponsibly and without consequence. Disdainful of women, contemptuous of mankind and God, utterly self-absorbed, ingenuous about vice, Pretorius is literally one hell of a guy. He is the climax of a noble line of cinematic Mephistos that include Mr. Scratch in All That Money Can Buy and Emil Janning's primordial Mephistopheles in F.W. Murnau's Faust. The return of Frankenstein malingered while James Whale shot One More River and developed A Trip to Mars, which was ultimately abandoned. He asked R.C. Sheriff to work on the sequel of Frankenstein, but Sheriff refused, as he said, to spend his summer writing pulp. Whale conceived a prologue with Mary Shelley as a legitimate frame, and Edmund Pearson wrote the earliest treatment. Whale brought in John Balderston, co-author of the Dracula and Frankenstein plays, and co-author of the film The Mummy. Now Hollywood's horror specialist, Balderston would contribute to the evolution of such horror films as Mad Love, Dracula's Daughter, and Mark of the Vampire. Raised in the Quaker faith, John Balderston balanced grim brutality and equally grim religious moralizing in his stories. Balderston worked through June and July 1934 on a workmanlike but unmagical script that supplies a roadmap but no gas. Rough narrative lines are there, but no spirit. Elsa Lanchester is there, indicated as the player for Mary Shelley and the monster's mate. The soul of the picture arrived with William Hurlbut in November 1934. Born in Illinois in 1886, Hurlbut had been a New York playwright for 30 years. He arrived at Universal as a dialogue writer on pictures such as The Cat Creeps when talkies came in. Trained as an illustrator, background in theater, a confirmed bachelor, Hurlbut and Whale shared much common ground. Whale wanted to treat the film as a hoot, and he found the idea of a female monster delirious. He preferred the title Bride of Frankenstein. With Hurlbut, Whale re-engineered the story on fanciful, witty lines. Dr. Pretorius, his miniature creations, Minnie and the Burgomaster, were all born. Balderston's piety was rather suspect. In his finale, the monster jealously kills Henry and the mate. an unbelievably maudlin scene, a priest, Father Gerard, convinces the monster to accept God. And the deity proves his love by dispatching the hapless brute with a lightning bolt, Deus ex machina. With Hurlbut, Whale developed the spiritual subtext into something meaningful and special.
I would like to drink to our partnership. Do you like gin? It is my only weakness. To a new world of gods and monsters.
The perfect line, the perfect staging. English gin in a chemist's retort, as drunken science toasts itself.
Stinky and enthralling, is it not? I cannot account precisely for all that I am going to show you. But perhaps now that you are my partner, you can.
The Cabinet of Dr. Pretorius. He has donned a medieval skullcap, an archaic fashion associated with alchemy, as depicted in Murnau's Faust and Paul Wagner's Der Golem. More like black magic than science. Pretorius is wardrobed in black, with high white, nearly clerical collar and cuffs, like an English country vicar. The skullcap makes the image discordant. The Reverend Dr. Pretorius, high priest of satanic arts. Special effects men John Fulton and David Horsley shot the little people over 2 days in full-scale jars against black velvet. This was meticulously lined up to fit the perspective of the production plates of Thesiger, Clive, and the practical jars. The film, or foreground plate, of the tiny people was rotoscoped, then matted into the background plate. As usual with John Fulton, the optical work is flawless. Joan Woodbury, formerly Nana Martinez, was at the start of her career portraying the little queen. In short order, she was a busy B-picture ingenue. The king is the image of Henry VIII, 16th century English sovereign. Henry defied the Catholic Church to divorce Catherine of Aragon, founding the Anglican Church into the bargain. The rutting little monarch is portrayed by English actor Arthur S. Byron. No, not Sir Joseph Wemple in The Mummy. That was Brooklyn-born Arthur Pops Byron. Elsa Lanchester's husband, Charles Laughton, had just copped an Academy Award playing Henry for Alex Korda. Norman Ainslie is the drowsy archbishop. The religious parody here is probably institutional and not canonical. The screenplay even indicated the nodding cleric's mitre askew at a, quote, deliberately non-episcopal angle. Peter Shaw plays the little devil, not as a cloven-hoofed satyr as in the script, but as an urbane Mephisto. Franz Waxman provides an off-kilter quotation from Faust by Charles Gounod. He would again write musical miniatures the following year for Todd Browning's The Devil Doll.
And no nonsense about angels and being good. Oh, there's the king out again. Even royal amours are nonsense.
Monty Montague is the stunt double as the mini monarch is airlifted to his bell jar. If you slow down the soundtrack right here, you can hear an engineer saying, "And the king gets picked up by the ears." Montague is the sleepy policeman and the invisible man. Bride of Frankenstein received its only Academy Award nomination for Best Sound Recording. Kansas DeForest plays the tiny toe dancer. Josephine McKim, in blonde wig and fins, was a 1932 Olympic swim champion. She was also Maureen O'Sullivan's nude body double in the erotic underwater pas de deux with Johnny Weissmuller, 1934's Tarzan and His Mate. In the right front bottle, seen from behind, is Billy Barty as the baby, seated in a high chair, rending a flower to bits and waving his rattle. Whale went over the top with this one and wisely eliminated the main business. The tyke is described in the script as looking like it might develop into Boris Karloff. "I think this baby will grow into something worth watching," quipped Pretorius.
"Listen, Henry Frankenstein. While you were digging in your graves, piecing together dead tissues, I, my dear pupil, went for my material to the source of life. I grew my creatures, like cultures. Grew them as nature does, from seed. But still, you did achieve results that I have missed. Now think, what a world-astounding collaboration."
The censor softened Pretorius's screenplay reference to scripture as fairy tales to Bible stories. Thesiger restores blasphemy with his inimitable reading of the line.
"And follow the lead of nature, or of God, if you like your Bible stories. Male and female."
A book novelization was prepared in England in 1936 by author Michael Harrison, writing as Michael Egremont. Harrison recalls consulting the script and a single screening of the film, but once was enough. In his story, Harrison Corley enunciates the flamboyant homosexuality that Ernest Thesiger brings to the character. Quote, "Let us obey the biblical injunction, be fruitful and multiply. You, of course," he tells Henry, "have the choice of natural means, but as for me, I am afraid there is no course open to me but the scientific method." He chuckled throatily, unquote. Curtain down on Act 1. Bride of Frankenstein is neatly structured in three acts, each lasting about 25 minutes. Karloff portrays the monster as a lost soul desperately seeking contact with humanity and desiring friendship. He's met by a population that responds with nothing but cruelty and anger. Will's brilliance in cutting is evident here. Cutting back to the hand already over the mouth. Truncating the action for effect.
There he is. Shoot!
Run to the village, quick! It's the monster! Tell the Burgomaster!
Among the villagers, that's John George, a diminutive character actor whose stature, or lack of it, made him a fixture as a decorative gargoyle in pictures like Babes in Toyland, the preview murder mystery East of Java, and Trick for Trick. You'll spot him again pushing to the front of the crowd before the dissolve. The sets for the earlier forest scenes are lush with waterfalls, grass, and fir trees. Here, as the monster is pursued and overcome by the mob, Whale, himself a former stage designer, has instructed his art director, Charles D. Hall, to provide an expressionistic forest of the dead, dirt, rocks, leafless trees like upright telephone poles, all the better to play the monster's crucifixion. Whale's style is often incorrectly called expressionistic. Whale used the style of expressionism when it suited him, as in this sequence in the Old Man River number in Showboat. Bride of Frankenstein is anything as Rococo, a robust commingling of the Baroque, the Gothic, the decorative, the expressionistic, and the derivative. Dwight Frye, body snatcher to the stars, will first be glimpsed leaning against a tree. David Lewis's sister is again kibitzing with the rabble. There's Dwight. Mr. Levy, wearing spectacles and leaning on his cane, has just darted behind E.E. Clive.
Cooperation. None at all.
The point is not that the monster is Christ. In Christian theology, Jesus is the Redeemer. His death and resurrection contain the promise of eternal life. The monster is the Son of Man, a gross parody of all that is human, lacking the divine spark, and therefore a mockery of the divine. Whale was an ironist, not a parodist. He doesn't crucify the monster to suggest that Golgotha was a cosmic joke. He punches the audience's buttons by inverting one of the fundamental traditions of Western culture. The monster, the Son of Man, is resurrected from the dead, then crucified. Strangely enough, the film would open on Good Friday, 1935. Everything about the look of the film is stylized. Nowhere do we see a natural sky. With glowering painted sky backings, it's as if a thunderstorm is always looming. In this instance, the sky has been filled with an architectural matte painting by Jack Cosgrove and Russell Lawson. These scenes are the only backlit exteriors in the picture, tightly composed on the old German village set from All Quiet on the Western Front.
Now take him down to the old dungeon, put him in chains.
Now come down and lock your door. We can't take the whole day over this.
I'd hate to find him under my bed at night. He's a nightmare in the daylight, he is.
Get away there! Clear that window!
Well, you mind your own business. And see he doesn't get out of here. He's dangerous.
Now I can get back to more important duties.
The monster's jailer here, who gives E.E. Clive some lip, the man without the mustache, is Charlie Murphy, curator of the Universal Zoo in the early 30s, and a frequent bit player in action pictures for Universal and Republic. Between the Breen office and the preview, much of the monster's rampage was cut, actually improving the picture. The fatter film contained a vignette in the Goldstadt morgue, followed by an inquest sequence where many and various villagers admit that they didn't actually witness any murders. The pompous burgomaster is still insisting there is no monster when the creature plucks him through the window, stands him up in the street, and cuffs him soundly about the head. Just as Minnie was spared in her encounter at the ruined mill, the burgomaster is a fool figure, the voice of the audience. He can be humbled, but he must not be killed. Fleeing in the crowd, we then met Auntie and Uncle Glutz, played by Tompa Pigott, and Gunas Davis, and their nephew, played by Dwight Fry in his amalgamated state. Arriving at their house, nephew killed his miserly uncle and stole his hoard, blaming it on the monster. The scene closed as nephew pondered the convenience of a scapegoat and mused that the monster might soon visit auntie. The communion girl who speaks is child actress Helen Parrish, sister of film director Robert Parrish. Helen grew up to become a leading lady in Three Smart Girls Grow Up and was Boris Karloff's ingenue in You'll Find Out in 1940. A shot of Frida's mother carrying the body was cut by the censor. On the left, gossiping with Una O'Connor, is David Lewis's mother, Fanny Levy, earning her $7.50 a day extra player's pay. Poor old Newman has been hacked to death by the monster. That's Walter Brennan gingerly handling the murder weapon. Mr. and Mrs. Newman's moans were dubbed in later to lessen the official body count. Perhaps the Newmans aren't dead yet, but in Monty Python fashion, are feeling much better after the dissolve.
Oh. There's another one in there. Frau Newman.
Ramona, you stay close to me. We'd better get away from these parts. It isn't safe.
Why?
I'm frightened.
The gypsy camp was added during reshoots in April to bridge the deletions in the village. Maurice Black plays the gypsy man, and Elspeth Dudgeon is his sour mother. She is made up deliberately to evoke Eva Moore's crusty matriarch in the old dark house. Elspeth also appeared in that film, billed as John Dudgeon, as the 102-year-old family patriarch. Whale used her again in Showboat and The Great Garrick. She is most memorable as the titular villain in a loony 1938 horror comedy for Warner Brothers, Shh, the Octopus. Elspeth played the octopus, not the imperative, and her climactic transformation as the grandmother from hell is an unsung high point of 30s horror movies. In a sequence inspired by an episode in Shelley's novel, the monster finds refuge with a blind hermit. Whale had shut the picture down February 19th to March 2nd, 1935, waiting for O.P. Heggie to finish a picture at RKO Radio Pictures. Whale was on dangerous ground here with the censor and the audience. One false step in this delicately charged material could quickly explode into maudlin sentimentality, ecclesiastical heresies, or baggy pants burlesque. The integrity of this performance from Heggie was crucial, or we would have had Mel Brooks 45 years ahead of schedule. The hermit is a saintly figure, aged, bearded, possessed of inner sight, deliberately wardrobed to suggest a New Testament figure.
Who's there?
Censor Joseph Breen had cautioned Whale that his script contained objectionable references to Dr. Frankenstein, that, quote, compare him to God and which compare his creation of the monster to God's creation of man. All such references should be eliminated. Craftily, Whale and Hurlbut retained these as shooting drew near. 3 weeks before production, Whale helpfully reminded Breen of his oversight in his last communication, quote, there are several points about God, entrails, immortality, and mermaids, which you did not bring up again, and I am very anxious to have the script meet with your approval in every detail.
Who is it? You're welcome, my friend, whoever you are.
Who are you?
I think you're a stranger to me. I cannot see you. I cannot see anything. You must please excuse me, but I'm blind.
Greg Menk asked Valerie Hobson, late in her life, if she could pinpoint why Bride of Frankenstein remained so popular. She replied, Karloff is so moving, like one of the great clowns who make you cry. I think this was the secret of its enduring success.
You're hurt, my poor friend. Come. Sit down. Now tell me, who are you?
Franz Waxman asked for Clifford Vaughn as his orchestrator, specifically because of Vaughn's expertise with the organ. The instrument is associated with sacred music, evident in the solo rendition of Schubert's Ave Maria. Oliver Wallace, later a mainstay of Disney's music department, was the session player on a Wurlitzer-style theater organ. Elsewhere, the organ is diametrically used for profane color, notably in the Danse Macabre of the Crypt sequence, and in multiple renditions of the Bride's theme. Vaughn also orchestrated for staff composers Edward Ward and Heinz Remheld in 1934-35. He was also a fine composer who contributed the memorable main title and recap music to Universal's first Flash Gordon serial.
We shall be friends. I have prayed many times for God to send me a friend. It's very lonely here, and it's been a long time since any human being came into this hut. I shall look after you, and you will comfort me. Now you must lie down and go to sleep. Yes, yes. Now you must sleep. Our Father, I thank thee that in thy great mercy thou hast taken pity on my great loneliness. And now, out of the silence of the night, hast brought two of thy lonely children together and sent me a friend to be a light to mine eyes and a comfort in time of trouble. Amen.
Film editor Ted Kent maintained that he executed the glowing crucifix behind this scene all on his own. Whale didn't much care for it, but let it stay. Symbols of Christian ritual are hidden in plain sight. When the monster says, "Bread good, wine good," he is really reading the Eucharist. This is the monster's Last Supper, complete with the holy sacraments of bread and wine. Soon, the Romans will come for him. Perhaps this explains the meaning of Dr. Pretorius's otherwise inexplicable name, from Praetor, a Roman magistrate. Like his namesake, Pretorius is his own law, meting out life and death. Ernest Thesiger would play a genuine Praetor in the CinemaScope epic The Robe. In teaching the monster the pleasures of a good cigar, Whale lets the creature indulge in the director's own trademark habit. When fire threatened to engulf Whale's home in the early 1950s, his cigars were the one thing he cared to rescue and stood by, calmly puffing, as he watched the blaze. Boris Karloff thought giving the monster speech was stupid and destroyed whatever impact he had. He argued against it. Karloff was right, for speech removed the alien remoteness of the creature. But with the original novelty now past, the monster could no longer be the totemic black engine of the first film. He had to be an evolving character and interact with the others, or he would become the lifeless prop that Karloff rightly sensed coming into being after Son of Frankenstein. Universal publicist refused to believe that the novelty was gone. A New York Times squib reported that during production, Lumley insisted that Karloff wear a veil over his monstrous features when walking to and from the stage, the same gambit that they had milked in 1931. The Times reporter was skeptical, who in 1935 didn't know already what the monster looked like.
This is wood for the fire. Wood. And this is fire. No, no. Fire is good.
Fire, no good. No.
There is good, and there is bad.
Good. Bad. Good.
Music.
The melody being fiddled by the hermit is an original by Franz Waxman called Children's Theme that will be quoted later at the end of this sequence. The hunters on the left, John Carradine and Robert Adair. Whale had already used Carradine in a small part in The Invisible Man, and in the 1940s, Carradine added the role of Count Dracula to his considerable resume. Toward the end of his life, Carradine raised eyebrows by insisting that he had turned down the role of the Frankenstein monster in 1931. Here Karloff emits the warning growl which Franz Waxman picked up on as the monster's secondary danger motive.
This is my friend.
Friend? This is the fiend that's been murdering half the countryside. Good heavens, man, can't you see? Oh, he's blind.
He isn't human. Frankenstein made him out of dead bodies.
Shortly, the monster will stumble into a group of schoolchildren and be posed before an icon of Jesus Christ. He beseeches the children and is again rejected by humanity. Marilyn Harris, the drowned Maria of the first film, is the leader of the schoolchildren. Also fleeing in the gaggle is child actress Calamansita Johnson. Whale has upgraded Marilyn's silent bit with one word of dialogue, making the part a higher-paying speaking role. He would use Marilyn again in Showboat and The Road Back. Balderson's July 23rd script had the angry monster wrestle and destroy a stone angel in the cemetery, literally a fallen angel. Hurlbut's shooting script had the monster come upon a large, crucified Nazarene, etched against a glowering sky. Seeing it as a living figure tortured as he had been, the monster toppled the effigy and attempted to free the priesters from the cross. The Marine office told Whale in no uncertain terms to find another monument. Whale savaged the ghost of the original intention by including the unmolested Christ icon in the margin. Censor cuts in Frankenstein had perverted the monster's poignant encounter with a little girl into an act of pedophilic depravity, as if Petorius the Burgomaster and Minnie were jointly running the production code administration, the most resonant Christian image was twisted into an act of godlessness. Casting sheets show that Dwight Fry was originally cast for his part here as Ghoul Number One. An anachronism of the screenplay retained Fritz, the hunchback assistant who had been killed by the monster in the first film. Dwight Fry Jr. recalls that Whale helped his father by creating roles, and Fry's Carl is an amalgam of four characters in the Hurlbut script: Pretorius' servant, first ghoul, nephew Glutz, and Fritz. This is why Fry has two different partners. Neil Fitzgerald here in the crypt as Rudy, a.k.a. Ghoul Number Two. Ted Billings as Ludwig will help to fly the kites at the climax.
Read the inscription. What does it say?
Dwight Fry's reading of the tombstone gives the story a definite anchor in time. He tells us the girl died in 1899. Corruption is complete, and now, years later, only her bones remain. As Universal's press book stated in 1935, the time of the story is the present, though clearly an alternate universe.
You want me to send you to the gallows where you belong?
Could be no worse than this.
But are you ready? Yes. Here goes. Pretty little thing in her way, wasn't she?
I hope her bones are firm.
It seems lighter now.
Yes. Well, Doctor, I guess that's all for tonight.
Can we go home now?
Yes. I shall wait here for a bit. I rather like this place.
Be careful nobody sees you leave.
All right, we know.
And leave me that lantern down there.
All right,
all right.
If there's much more like this, what you say, pal? We give ourselves up and let them hang us.
That goes for me, too.
This is no life for murderers.
Déjeuner sur le creek. The drunken doctor blows smoke in the face of death, just as Henry had tossed dirt at the Grim Reaper in the original film. Franz Waxman titled this cue Danse Macabre, using organ and padded xylophone to mock the skeletal decor in three-quarter time. This is the role of a lifetime for Ernest Thesiger. A true eccentric, his performance here draws much from his private persona. Valerie Hobson remembered him as a terribly sweet man with a good heart. Quote, "I don't think he had a very strong male approach to things," she told historian Greg Mank. "He was one of the very first people to make almost camp fun. He did it as a serious thing, you know. Sort of the arched eyebrow and arched nostril," unquote. Elsa Lanchester recalled him as weird, strange, and acid-tongued. Thesiger opened in the play A Sleeping Clergyman at the Theater Guild, New York, on October 8, 1934. When it closed after 40 performances, he was able to train West to join the cast of Bride after the New Year. Reading Pretorius's dialogue, it is easy to hear Claude Rains' brushed velvet tones and imagine the cynical, twinkling bemusement with which he played Captain Renault in Casablanca. That same dialogue plays very differently when enunciated by the man who, in the old dark house, spoke the phrase, "Have a potato," and endowed it with 7 levels of malevolence.
Woman.
Thesiger's best film roles are all macabre. Less well known than The Old Dark House and The Ghoul are his parts as Marley's Undertaker in the Alistair Sim version of Scrooge, the asthmatic industrial tycoon swathed in furs in The Man in the White Suit, a 19th century wraith who must release his dead lover's soul from the body of a possessed girl in the 1948 British thriller A Place of One's Own, and the milquetoast Mr. Hoover, the silk stocking killer, the 1938 Warner Brothers British production They Drive by Night. Pretorius's preoccupation with the female being radiates an unhealthy, prurient interest. As the monster realizes the implication of the word wife, Thesiger's glance suggests that Pretorius will be a most interested spectator on the honeymoon.
Woman. Friend. Why?
That Dr. Pretorius is here again, sir.
There. I knew it. Send him away. I won't see him.
I certainly will.
Good evening, Henry. Baroness, I've not yet had the opportunity of offering you my congratulations on your marriage. Pray accept them now.
Dr. Pretorius, I don't know what your business is with my husband, but whatever it may be, I tell you frankly that I am not frightened of it or of you. Henry's been very ill. He's in no state to be alarmed or annoyed. Your visit now is most unwelcome.
Henry, I heard the carriage drive up. I'll see that the baggage is put in.
Then we're leaving.
Whale had a good film editor in Ted Kent, but Kent was the first to credit his director with pinpointing precisely where and when to cut, both to punch dialogue and to catch the eye. Notice the opposing shots here of Thesiger and Clive, each pushing into close-ups. This symmetrical pairing of shots will be seen again in the creation sequence.
No, no. Don't tell me of it. I don't want to hear. I've changed my mind. I won't do it.
I expected this. I thought we might need another assistant. Perhaps he can persuade you.
Nothing can persuade me.
We shall see.
Another bravura entrance here as the monster is revealed at the door.
Except when crossed.
The successively closer cuts play on our memory of the first film and repeat its impact. Whale reveals his strange characters in this fashion frequently. Rains in The Invisible Man, Karloff in The Old Dark House, even Colin Clive in One More River. This time, the monster is the master, as the sit-down tutorial from the first film is inverted, with Henry as pupil.
What do you want?
No.
This is your work.
Yes.
I'll have no hand in such a monstrous thing.
Yes, must.
Get him out. I won't even discuss it until he's gone.
Go now. Go! Must do it.
Never. Nothing can make me go on with it.
In Hurlbut's script, Elizabeth is stolen off-screen. Valerie and Boris were to appear together for only one shot in the cave. Whale realized his error in omitting the Beauty and the Beast ritual, and on the soundstage, seized this opportunity to make, not a parody, but a reprise of Elizabeth's symbolic rape in the first film. The setting is again the bedroom. But with Frau Frankenstein no longer a Fraulein, the bed is less functional furniture than associative backdrop to Elizabeth's abduction by her robber bridegroom.
Nervous, my lady, and I don't like leaving you alone.
Oh, nonsense, Minnie. I shall be all right.
I hope so, my lady.
Is that you, Henry?
Here's another good example of Whale and Hurlbut's good theatrical instincts. As written, Pretorius and Dr. Frankenstein remain together during this episode. Pretorius merely shrugs at the suggestion that he is responsible for the abduction. On the set, Whale contrives for Pretorius to make another grand entrance, smashing the bric-a-brac while the camera dollies in to a low angle to punch the impact of the moment.
To do nothing and say nothing of this episode, I assure you that the Baroness will be safely returned if you will leave everything to me. Nothing, that is, except what he demands. Oh, I admit I'm beaten. But if you can bring her back, I'll do anything that you want. Are you ready to complete with me this final experiment?
What about Elizabeth?
She is well, and will be safely returned if you will proceed.
I'm ready.
Here's another James Whale trademark, moving his camera directly through the wall of a set. The watchtower set from the first film is revisited, with an overreaching crossbeam now spanning the staircase, just in case one feels like hanging oneself from a convenient rafter. All of the mordant pleasantries about slimy steps and the charms of the house are ad-libs. The next 4 minutes are mainly the contribution of John Balderston. The immediate necessity of a fresh heart is one full incident retained from his script. Pretorius' line to Henry about once upon a time being burnt at the stake as wizards for the experiment is rather ingenuous. The good doctor fails to consider that kidnapping, grave robbing, corpse mutilation, and murdering young girls for their body parts, have I forgotten anything, might merit the gallows if not the stake. This line was spoken in Balderston's script by a professor of anatomy while energizing dead frog parts with a galvanic battery. In his June 23rd screenplay, Balderston shamelessly rehashed the medical school business of the first film, even to reviving the deceased hunchback Fritz. Apparently nothing is impossible when your boss is Dr. Frankenstein. Fritz procures a desiccated specimen from the school, enraging Henry, who demands a fresh one and offers the 1,000-crown bounty. Fritz obliges. In the Great Depression, people would do anything for money.
This heart is useless. I must have another. And it must be sound and young. Carl, you must go to your friend at the accident hospital.
What we need is a female victim of sudden death. Can you do it?
You promised me 1,000 crowns. It will be well worth it, and the Baron will pay.
Yes, yes. Go and get it.
I'll try.
There are always accidental deaths occurring.
Always.
Having appeared in every conceivable crowd scene in the picture for $7.50 a day, it seemed that the only way to get David Lewis's sister, Leah Vision, off the picture was to kill her. But it was worth it for Leah. Talent records show that the Goldstadt Street victim was a $50 turn. Hardly 1,000 crowns, but not to be sneezed at in 1935. One myth that has been repeated over the years held that the fresh heart for the bride was at one time intended to be Elizabeth's. A still photograph of Dwight Frye hovering near Valerie Hobson with a knife, and the bride's instantaneous attraction to Henry have been cited as proofs. At no time was this ever considered. More is the pity that it wasn't. It's completely in tune with the story, and Elizabeth died anyway in the final cataclysm, at least until the preview.
Police case? Yes, very sad, only we can't bother about that now. Can I do anything?
No, no, no! I can work better alone.
Work. Where's Elizabeth? Have you brought her?
She
He wait. I wait.
I'm exhausted. I must get sleep.
Work. Finish. Then sleep.
The monster's recitation of the work ethic to Henry is also courtesy of Balderston. Cinematographer John Meskell had first done some work for Whale on The Invisible Man before filming By Candlelight, The Kiss Before the Mirror, Bride of Frankenstein, and Showboat for the director. Meskell was an alcoholic. On the set, he was efficient and produced luminous work, provided that he made it to the set, which the studio ensured by sending a car daily. Despite a good rapport, Whale finally sacked Meskell for drunkenness on the set of the much-troubled The Road Back. By the late 1950s, he was working for Roger Corman and ended his days on Skid Row. His work on Bride ranks it as one of the most exquisitely photographed films ever. In a 1935 interview with Movie Makers, magazine of the Amateur Cinema League, Meskell spoke of his use of Rembrandt lighting and made it clear that in spite of the shade of grease paint Jack Pierce applied, the monster was never intended to be a jolly green giant, but a dead, white corpse. Quote, "With variations, Rembrandt lighting is what is used throughout the picture, a hard and contrasty light with deep, rich shadows and brilliant highlights. It involves neither a straight cross light nor a flat light directly from the front, but rather a combination of the two, with the light originating from a point in front and to one side of the objects to be photographed. The style tends to impart a roundness to the features, and this pseudo-stereoscopic effect is heightened by arranging for a dark background behind the bright side of the face and vice versa. It was our desire to maintain an eerie, mysterious atmosphere. Supplementary lights were projected from odd angles, especially when we were dealing with Karloff. Many of the settings were filled with dark shadows. The sets themselves were constructed with distorted walls involving many angles and offsets. In scenes in which only the monster appeared, the camera, equipped with a short-angle lens, was placed low and comparatively close to the subject, and thus was gained the impression of a distorted figure and unusual height. In a contrary fashion, we placed the camera at a high elevation in photographing the rascally Pretorius, and thus achieved the effect of a bulging cranium. To give the effect of deadness, Karloff's makeup was blue-green in color, and the light on him was projected through blue filters. When other characters appeared in a scene with him, the makeups of the others were pink or reddish in tone, and lights of a corresponding shade had to be trained on them, while the blue lights must be shielded from them." Unquote.
"It's beating quite normally now. Bring it over.
The laboratory scenes are patterned in equal parts on sequences from two silent films produced in Europe. They are The Creation of the Female Robot in Fritz Lang's 1927 Metropolis, filmed in Germany, and the medieval climax of the 1926 Rex Ingram film The Magician, filmed in France.
"Isn't it amazing, Henry, that lying here within this skull is an artificially developed human brain? Each cell, each convolution ready, waiting for life to come. Look, the storm is coming up over the mountains. It will be here soon.
The kites! Are the kites ready?"
"Yes.
Then send them up as soon as the wind rises. Hurry, hurry!"
The kites, get them ready.
Kenneth Strickfaden designed and built the electrical apparatus. "I got my start in high school from my interest in science," he said. "Otherwise, I might have been a teenage werewolf." His high-voltage Art Deco assemblages, all sizzle and no steak, are the original light show, a defining image of science fiction. Mrs. Strickfaden didn't think much of horror pictures. "She's no fan," he said. "I have to remind my wife that she lives in a house built and paid for by Frankenstein." Universal's publicity would claim after the fact that an intense hunt had been mounted to engage the bride. The exhibitor's trade magazine, Universal Weekly, named a few also-rans. Brigitte Helm, the malevolent female robot from Metropolis. Phyllis Brooks, a fashion model just edging her way into supporting roles. And Arletta Duncan, Universal bit player who had been Mae Clark's maid of honor in Frankenstein. Poor Arletta, always a bridesmaid, never a bride. But Whale knew who he wanted, and Elsa Lanchester's name, with a question mark, is prominent on the cast page of Balderston's first draft, June 9, 1934. It's still there 6 weeks later in the June 23rd script, only now Elsa is indicated as both Mary Shelley and the mate. Ted Kent's montage for the creation sequence is as artistically valid as anything by Sergei Eisenstein, and it won't give you an urge to take up collective farming. Noted in the 1970s that the first three notes of the bride's musical theme are the same as the first three notes of the song Bally High from South Pacific. By the 1990s, this casual observation became conflated into an urban legend that had Franz Waxman suing and receiving a hefty settlement from Oscar Hammerstein. The Waxman archives confirm that no litigation occurred. In any event, Franz would hardly have sued the librettist over Richard Rogers' composition. And there are, after all, only eight notes in the diatonic scale. Waxman's score for Fritz Lang's 1933 French production Lilian, the Fox Europa, caught Whale's ear, particularly the ethereal music for the heaven sequence, with its airy coloring of Celeste and Andy's Martineau, an early electronic instrument. Mere days before production would start on January 2nd, Whale and Waxman met at a Christmas party. Whale explained that nothing in the story would be resolved. Everyone would die, and offered Waxman the job if he would give him an unresolved musical score. The orchestra for the bride sessions was conducted by Konstantin Bakalanikov. Session photographs show 32 players on the recording stage, 14 of whom are violinists. Orchestration sheets reveal that at its largest, the recording orchestra consisted of 40 players. The Waxman music appeared memorably in Universal's second and third Flash Gordon serials. Cues from Waxman's score have been recorded by Charles Gerhardt and Eric Kunzel. In 1993, Kenneth Alwyn conducted the first substantial recording of the nearly complete score. Waxman's use of tuned timpani here echoes the heartbeat of the Monster Bride. Horace's monster in the first film looked like Triage at an auto wreck. His face and torso swathed in bandages, naked legs truncating in size 16, triple E foot splints. The script called for the mate to give the effect of an Egyptian mummy, and this was realized exactly, including leg bindings. Bride be beautiful or ghastly, Whale fools us with quick, progressively closer cuts, deliberately non-matching, alternating from diffuse to crisp. He even has the actress's mouth stuffed with wadding to distort and swell her features for one flash cut. Dr. Pretorius, bridesmaid to the bride. Franz Waxman provides what he knows. The script described Elsa's do as, quote, curled close to her head, hanging straight and dark on either side. Keeping to the Egyptian mummy idea, Whale and Jack Pierce memorably designed this Nefertiti number. Lanchester's own hair is marcelled and swept back on a wire cage. She looks like she has just stuck her finger in a light socket. The white electric bolts from her temples add the final exclamation points. Monster coiffure would never be the same. Elsa's streaks and tips set a fashion craze for Raffaella Ottiano in The Devil Doll, Ramsey Ames in The Mummy's Ghost, Humphrey Bogart in The Return of Dr. X, even Boris Karloff himself in The Walking Dead. Elsa Lanchester told Greg Mank, quote, Jack Pierce did really feel like he made these people, like he was a god who created human beings. Lanchester elaborated in her memoirs. Quote, he had his own sanctum sanctorum, and as you entered, you did not go in, you entered. He said good morning first. If I spoke first, he glared and slightly showed his upper teeth. He would be dressed in a full hospital doctor's operating outfit. At 5 a.m, this made me dislike him intensely. Another Baroque camera angle with a short lens to keep the bride weirdly distorted.
My goddess.
Look out! The lever!
Get away from that lever! You'll blow us all to atoms!
No one can explain the presence of this lever, unless it's lever to heaven. Lanchester said that she cultivated her hiss by observing angry swans at Regent's Park in London. The Production Code Administration had screened Whale's original cut on March 20th and demanded changes. Subsequently, the picture was previewed at 92 minutes on April 6th, and in this form, reviewed by The Hollywood Reporter. Green approved it on April 15th. Mere days before the April 19th San Francisco Good Friday opening, Whale relented on the script's, quote, positively final fade-out, and reshot the ending so that Henry and Elizabeth would live. Yes, there was going to be a son of Frankenstein. Waxman's unresolved musical ending now had a coda, cracked from the creation cue. James Whale's biographer, James Curtis, tells us that Whale had the last laugh. Taking friends to a revival showing in the late 1940s, the director was snickering audibly at his ironic creation when an irate moviegoer whipped around in her seat. If you don't like the show, she commanded, you can damn well leave. 65 years later, no one in the audience is leaving.